Don't be a Sigma. It's Nescapades, a chronological journey through the North American Super Nintendo library with a few pit stops along the way. We play them briefly, we judge them harshly, we rank them. That is pretty much all you need to know. I'm Chase Keys.
I'm Emmy Zero.
And folks, we've got another Playing with Power episode today. I'm really excited about this one. We are talking about the January 1994 issue of Nintendo Power. This is exciting for a couple of reasons. One, new year, we're finally in 1994. We are finally talking about 1994 stuff. It is about Mega Man X, a game that we seem to be kind of fond of here. It's an escapade. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe just a little bit, yeah.
It is a bonus issue, so this issue is just packed, just crammed with stuff in it. Cool stuff to talk about. It's even got a cool silver cover, which we'll talk a little bit about here in just a bit as well. So, this is an exciting issue. I'm excited.
Me too. It really is exciting. And we were in 1993 for so long, people. It feels bizarre to be talking about games from a different year that is further in the future than that, truly. And 94 has some really great stuff in it, so I'm really excited that we're kicking it off with this issue that has a really, you know, major cover story feature about a game that, like Chase said, we've been looking forward to for a long time. So yeah, I'm very excited about all of this, and what do you say?
Well, I say let's go check in with Newsy really fast, because the sooner we do that, the sooner we can crack into this issue. So, Newsy.
All right.
Newsy, take it away.
It's January 1994. The Air Up There opens and goes on to grow 16 million. Is that all? It appears it actually lost the top spot that month to Mrs. Doubtfire, which came out 2 months prior. And also six other movies that came out the previous month. It didn't do as well as Beethoven's Second. Not a good month for movies. Mariah Carey continues her reign that began in December with Hero before losing the top spot at the end of the month, where it would be shared by Bryan Adams, Rod Stewart, and Sting with their hit All for Love. And the Zapatista Army of National Liberation would begin their 12-day conflict against the Mexican Army in the Mexican state of Chiapas. The conflict started over the Zapatistas' objection to the signing of the North American Free Trade Agreement. The Zapatistas continue to occupy much of that region to this very day, despite there being no formal peace treaty between them and the Mexican government. Back to you, Emmy Zero and Chase Keys.
All right, thank you, Newsy.
So, The Air Up There, that is, I don't know if I've ever heard of this movie before.
Well, you see, it's a Kevin Bacon movie where he goes to Africa to coach a basketball team.
Uh-huh.
Because that's definitely something that they needed over in Africa, was a white guy to teach them how to play basketball, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely. Wow. Okay. I really, really believe that is a movie that would have existed in the 90s. I'm honestly surprised it was not like a bigger hit, given how easy of a sell this probably would have been for audiences at that point. But maybe it's maybe beyond the wildly offensive concept, it's also a badly made film. But yeah, legitimately, never heard of it before today, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I don't know a whole lot about it, other than what I saw about it on the Wikipedia article when researching this for Newsy. It also looks like it might have been like one of the only movies to come out in January. I mean, like, January's always been, and
January's not, it's a dumping ground for movies, basically, you know, especially back then, absolutely. I think. So,
could not compete with Mrs. Doubtfire, a movie which totally holds up, I'm sure.
I'm sure it does. Oh, the director of The Air Up There, his next movie was Kazam.
Oh.
The one with Shaq.
Great.
Where he plays a genie.
Great films. Great.
Yeah.
Great films.
Great, really great films, yeah.
I don't have a whole lot to say about the music stuff this month. We talked about Mariah Carey's Hero last month, and I don't even know this other song with, God, I guess Sting and Rod Stewart slumming it with Bryan Adams over here.
Yeah, I don't have anything about that, honestly, either. I don't know. January. Look, everybody's just, they're recovering from the holiday season. There's not a lot of time for exciting new media at that point. So
unless you're the Super Nintendo, in which case you're going to get Mega Man X.
That is easily the most exciting piece of pop culture, you know, new release to happen in this month, it seems like. So, you want to talk about it? Our boy X here, he's on the cover of the magazine.
He is. He's on both covers of the magazine because this magazine had like a shiny silver coat over its regular cover. Was this a thing they were doing in comic books around this time? Because I definitely remember there was a time in which comic books were popular again, and they would make these special editions with, you know, shiny things on the cover. Like, yeah, the Spider-Man issue where he's in his metal armor, so it's got the shiny silver cover on it.
Right. Yeah. So this is definitely the period of time when the big, like, speculators boom was happening in comic books. And, yeah, they were doing all that stuff with, like, foil covers and holographic covers and all these, like, special editions of comics that you were supposed to be able to, like, buy and hold on to for 20 years and, like, put your kids through college using. So, yeah, this feels like it's kind of a similar trend. We'll actually see a few trends of the moment represented in this magazine. Metallic silver cover of this, I bet it was pretty striking in real life. I bet it was pretty cool to look at. Yep,
I bet it was too. Sadly, I missed out on this one, so I don't actually know what it really looked like in person. So we got our big silver issue with the bonus issue on there, the embossed image of X and the Nintendo Power logo, and then we turn the page onto the regular cover. This is kind of a strange picture of X. It's a little bit off in certain ways.
It is a little bit off. Like, looking at it, and especially flipping back and forth between the, like, extremely, I mean, even though it is just a silhouette, basically, the version of him that's on the silver embossed cover is a lot more on model than this version on the regular cover. Yeah, it's a sort of strange pose, and his, like, proportions look a little off, I guess I would say.
And it looks like they really tried to make him look more robotic here. Like, he doesn't have, you know, like the goofy anime hand. He's got like a very robotic looking hand, the hand that isn't, you know, an arm cannon.
Yeah, you can see, like, he's got like really visible, like kind of mechanical joints in his fingers.
Yes.
And like, they've really kind of emphasized, like, there's this kind of, like, I don't know, like a rubber gusset or something around his, like, his knee and his, like leg joint, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, that just feels like them putting more detail into this to make it look really, like, I don't know, like, cool and almost like he's like wearing a space suit or something, you know?
Yeah, like, he's got rivets in his chest armor, it looks like. It's an interesting take on the character that, again, you know, is really trying to emphasize his robo-ness, which, you know, I think downplayed a lot in his more anime-looking incarnations from his home country of Japan.
You know, importantly, though, he does still have the very anime face.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I'm glad they haven't tried to redraw his face to look more Western comic book or Western cartoon style. So it still does look like him. It's just a weird, like, oddly embellished version.
Yeah, you could fill many a coffee table book with the very odd and not very good interpretations of Mega Man when Western artists have gotten hold of him back in the day.
Definitely.
Including ones that appeared on box covers. So,
you know it.
Yeah, moving on, we actually open up the magazine. Got an ad for Nintendo Power itself, as Nintendo Power is wont to do, talking about, you know, maybe hey, get a friend to subscribe too.
I feel like this is like people from a different era than like the kids reading the magazine would be from. I had designed this ad, you know, because it's like a picture of like a baseball with some shattered glass around it. And the text says, get a friend into something besides trouble. It's sort of like advertising a referral program. where if you get your friend into Nintendo Power, you'll get 4 superpower stamps. That's cute. It's fun. I don't know. I feel like there's like a lot of stuff about baseball in the like media that was made for our generation. And like, I don't think anybody that I knew was ever that into baseball personally. So, yeah.
I mean, I think part of it depended greatly on where you lived. And I
certainly, yeah, you
know, I spent.
I mean, that's the thing. We didn't have an MLB team.
Yeah.
In Jacksonville. So, you know, it's yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like I spent a good chunk of my childhood in a city that was very much a baseball city first and foremost when it came to professional sports. I also got a guy snowboarding with a Game Boy. You know, you can take it anywhere, even snowboarding. You can take your Game Boy snowboarding. Also, so we move on to the player pulse section where folks can write into Nintendo Power and maybe have their letters printed in the magazine and have Nintendo Power people snarkily comment on them. We also have some interesting envelope art here as well. People would like to draw.
Yeah, they're really emphasizing the envelope art in this one. We have obviously, you know, some Mario characters.
Mm-hmm.
We have what looks like some Zelda characters.
Yeah,
I don't know. The Zelda one is interesting to me. Are those Zelda characters, or did they just accidentally draw somebody who looks very similar to Princess Zelda alongside a bunch of other anime looking characters? No, that's got to be Zelda because she's got the Triforce on her. Like,
yeah, we've definitely got Zelda there. That looks like Maki from Final Fight?
I don't know. Maybe it's just like cool ladies in video games.
Yeah.
Maybe that's cool.
I dig that because it sometimes feels like, you know, I mean, especially around this time, it was not a priority to, you know, like try and market games to girls. But
yeah,
we've got that. We also have like a 19-year-old who wrote in talking about how she likes to draw, and she drew like a cool like version of Link that looks like a lady. Is it
yeah, that does look like that. I've been looking at this. I think that to me that does look like a lady Link, and that's cool. And a really nice drawing of her. Yeah, this is the envelope art that this person sent in, and it's got Link, it's got an owl, it's got kind of a nice, like, you know, sort of beach with like you know, some dunes with like a sword, you know, stuck in them. And yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Susan Van Sant, if you're out there, let us know how things are going.
Yeah, hope your career is going well if you're still doing art, if you're doing it professionally, and just hope you're having a good life.
Looks like Blanca versus Vega in one of those envelopes. We also have Cyclops, which is an interesting decision. I know X-Men was super popular around this time, but not a whole lot of X-Men games yet.
I don't know. Somebody just thought Cyclops was really cool and drew a picture of him. It's cool. I like all of these. I like all these pieces of envelope art, and I wonder how many of these they got like every month.
Oh, I'm sure they got a ton. I mean, like, I think we've talked about it before. Back when we worked at Nintendo, they still had like large frames just full of these old envelopes.
Yes, they did.
So they're
a lot of these are absolutely
probably still around somewhere at Nintendo of America.
Probably, yeah. I hope so. I hope they're still around and being well taken care of. Aside from the letter from Susan, there's only 3 letters here, and they're all responses to the sort of in-depth article on the making of Super Empire Strikes Back, which are mostly people being like, this was a really cool feature. I love learning how games are made. Please do more of these. And then one person who's like, this was so boring. Don't do this again. I like the idea that, you know, people reading this magazine maybe had their first exposure to any kind of like more in-depth journalism about how games are made via any of these like, you know, features that show up in Nintendo Power. Moving right along to our boy X.
Mega Man's Tour de Force mission is upon us. I wonder if... No, they do. I was almost like, I wonder if they know this is a different character from Mega Man.
They do know that this is a different character because they do actually have a little bit of lore in here that is the stuff that, if you know Mega Man X lore, is still the case. You know, last prototype developed by Dr. Light. Unearthed by Dr. Kane, used as the prototype for all of the Reploids, and, you know, all that stuff is here. Also, thing to note, the image of X here, this is definitely just like the box art for Mega Man X. This is the image that the weird version of X on the cover is a redraw of. And this one is much more anime. It looks very glossy, and there's a lot less of an effort to make him look robotic here.
Not a whole lot of original art in this one. This all looks like the sort of Capcom art from...
Yeah, it does.
You know, like the instruction manual and everything else. Also, they made an interesting decision to... title each stage with an image of a random enemy from that stage, which, you know what, I kind of appreciate.
Yeah, no, totally.
And as always, you know, par for the course for this sort of thing, we've got you know, a lot of screenshots that are being put together to make big old maps of stages. It's pretty cool seeing it all laid out here. I always like that stuff.
It is. And, you know, even in the little images here, the sprite work all looks really good. I love the designs for the Mavericks in Mega Man X.
Yeah.
Like, I think they're all great. And, you know, just seeing them here in kind of this layout is, I don't know, it's really satisfying to know that we're finally here.
That weird bird enemy with the buzzsaw on its head that, like, you know, it flips around almost like a drinking bird and then
throws the... And then it, like, slings the buzzsaw at you. Yeah.
That one, I'll bet, is original Nintendo power art. It's got this sort of, like, bubbly, balloony look to it that they used in the old... Mega Man 2 art that they created specifically for that issue. It just kind of reminds me of that.
Okay. Do you think the images of, like, the little robot bats and the robot bunny, you know, that's a little bit later on in this, are the same deal?
Yeah,
I think that probably is true. I think that's probably true of all of them. They've got clearly the images of the bosses that are taken from official art that Capcom gave them. And then I think all these images of just, like, random enemies are probably original to the magazine.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
That makes sense, yeah.
But yeah, I think we get all the stages here. I think we get, like, I think it gives us the locations of all of the heart tanks.
I had a lot of really delightful moments of, like, discovering stuff when I was playing this game originally. And a lot of the things, like, you know, the specific locations of X's upgrades and the heart tanks and some of the little gimmicks that are specific to the stages are all just laid out here. So I'm kind of glad I didn't see this is a cool feature, and this is what Nintendo Power does. I am kind of glad in this particular case that I got to sort of experience this game cold back in the day, you know?
Yeah, I was kind of the same way. And there were a few things I picked up from, you know, probably like classified information and counselor's corners pieces on specific things. But for the most part, yeah, I just kind of went through the game on my own and figured things out. Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, that there is a really fun sort of sense of discovery with these first couple Mega Man games, certainly, that maybe you kind of miss out on just having it all laid out here. Like, you know, maybe if the magazine was more interested in, like, giving you little nudges, you know, and hints about, like, hey, maybe check this out.
But I don't know, also. I don't know if kids process that kind of stuff the same way. Yeah. That it's impossible for me to say, right, what I would have felt like if I'd read this before playing the game, because that's not what happened. So, yeah, but I don't know. I, like I said, I'm kind of glad that I didn't have this stuff all in the back of my mind when I was playing it. But yeah, like, they really do give this game, like, the proper spotlight treatment here. And definitely makes me excited to jump in and play it. So yeah.
One thing that's interesting about this is that I don't think they actually give you a breakdown of what bosses are weak to what weapons.
For the most part, that's true. I think they mention a couple of things here. Oh, yeah,
you're right, they do.
They do mention, like, you know, using the like, electrical attacks on the electrical weapon on armored armadillo. You know, it's not consistent. It's not like every one of these gets like its full strategy detailed, but there's not nothing either.
And then one thing we do not get is a breakdown of the Sigma stages. We get some pictures of some of the bosses, but that's about it.
Yeah, yeah. So they want to give you, you know, kind of a tease of that, but they do keep it a kind of a mystery. I can't imagine that the people subscribing to Nintendo Power needed a big push to be excited for the first Mega Man game on the Super Nintendo, but I bet this did the trick either way.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I was very excited for this, and it is still one of my favorite games to this day. And we will talk more about it very soon.
I guess right now though, we should jump over and talk about Flashback, because that's the next feature up in the magazine here. And Flashback. We have not. So we're going to talk a lot of the games that are sort of heavily featured in this magazine are actually ones we've played already. But I don't believe Flashback is one of those. Right. We haven't actually hit that in our chronological journey. Right.
Correct. Yeah. We have not played Flashback. We played. I'm trying to think.
You're talking about Out of This World.
Yeah, we've played Out of This World. This is sort of a spiritual successor, although I don't know if it's an actual sequel to that game.
It's not an actual sequel to that game. It's made by the same overall developer, though not the same specific people as Out of This World, and it is a similar kind of game. It's a what we call a cinematic platformer, basically, like in the mold of like Prince of Persia or something like that.
Yeah, this one looks like it's going less for the cinematic stuff in the actual gameplay. Although, I mean, we don't know how it plays yet. I have not actually touched this one before, but it looks a lot less like it's trying to do that sort of polygonal thing that the original one was.
Right. Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see how all that works out.
I think because this one has kind of a puzzle element to how you move through its levels, it does the breakdown of the kind of, you know, the stages, but it does it in a way that is more focused on guiding you through the steps here than in like pointing out tips and secrets and stuff. It's a good feature. It's really robust. I like this like green background with like silhouettes of jungle foliage that we have behind everything here. I think that gives it kind of like a nice different vibe for this feature. And I'm interested to play this. I'm really hot and cold on this style of platformer, but I hope I like this one. So.
Yeah, I mean, we thought that Out of This World worked a lot better than we were expecting it to on the Super Nintendo.
Yeah, we definitely did. Yeah.
So I'm really interested to see how this one goes, because it looks like it's better suited to the system, just from what I can tell from these screenshots. But
right,
it's really going to come down to what this game looks like in motion and how it feels to play.
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm kind of excited to check this one out.
Same. Are you excited to check out the next game up here? Claymates.
I could take it or leave it.
These guys look like nightmares. Truly the designs for these. I mean, they intentionally, I'm sure this is what they were going for, but Claymates. This is kind of Clay Fighter adjacent, I guess you'd say.
This is another game that's kind of developed using clay figures as, you know, the models for the sprites, just like Clay Fighter was. But this one's a platformer where you're playing as little creatures, like little animals. You're not playing as big old angry snowmen or people made of taffy that want to murder people who impersonate Elvis.
We have a fun image here, which I imagine is just the game's box art. Mm-hmm. Of all these like clay figure animals with like big manic smiles on their faces.
Yeah.
I think the fish and the mouse are particularly horrifying.
Yes, yeah. It looks like they're kind of trying to make them look, oh, hey, we're crazy, you know, like that.
Right, but, yeah. We're not just cute, we're weird.
I'll be honest, I don't think they go far enough. This game feels like tonally very, very different from Clay Fighter in a way that seems kind of strange to me.
I agree, yeah. At what point does the aesthetic here stop being like part of the joke and just being an ugly aesthetic, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Like, I would have expected something from the studio that made Clay Fighter to want to have more of an edge to it for this platformer, but it kind of doesn't seem to have that.
Not really. It does seem mechanically like it might be kind of an interesting game. There's different, each of the different claymates, the animals that you can transform into, has a different kind of moveset, basically. And they really emphasize in the feature here how big this game is, like how many different stages and different like types of gameplay there are. So I'm kind of curious about like whether it's actually, you know, whether that stuff all coheres and just or if it's like too ambitious and just kind of messy. But yeah, I don't think the aesthetic and the look of the thing is not, to me at least, doing it any favors.
There's a few little remarks in here that are kind of funny in the context of when this came out. Like, we're talking about a mouse named Uzi. Uzi is faster than a hedgehog.
Yeah, yeah.
And like a hedgehog, he's difficult to control. Shots fired.
That's right. Got to keep the low-key animosity going. Yeah, you didn't expect there to just be a random dig at Sonic somewhere in this magazine, or you probably did, but you don't know where it's going to come up. So yeah,
which is kind of funny because you're chasing down these shapes, one of which is a circle that just looks like a golden ring from Sonic the Hedgehog.
Does just look like a golden ring. It's true.
I don't know. I'll wait to actually play this one before I pass any judgment on it.
The feature does not excite me, and it's aesthetically, this is the least appealing like layout we've had in the magazine this time. It's just white backgrounds. The headings for all the sections look very like circusy. You know, it's there's just like different colored letters and not really much in the way of like art or anything in here. It's all screenshots. So I don't know. This feature feels to me kind of like it was put in as like an obligation and not a thing anybody working on the magazine had a ton of actual excitement over.
We do get the big maps, which we've got some very large levels here, it looks like, that, you know, are kind of those airplane hangar levels.
Always makes me nervous when I see something that looks like an airplane hangar level, so hopefully they're better than those can often be.
But, yeah, the other thing that's kind of disappointing about it is that, like, the maps don't look all that exciting, and for a game where, like, the big selling point is like, hey, look how cool these characters look, they're all made of clay, that they didn't put that kind of care into the construction of the world around those characters.
Right, yeah. They're very, very basic, very generic looking platform game levels that don't look at all like they share the same aesthetic as the characters. No,
definitely not. They look very plain in a way that's kind of disappointing. But again, you know, we'll wait until we actually play the game before we go too hard on it.
Maybe we'll love it. Who knows? We already know how we feel about is the next one up. Yeah. Soldiers of Fortune, aka the Chaos Engine, which we just recently talked about, but which is getting the full feature treatment here.
We got our titular Soldiers of Fortune, or well, I guess a couple of them anyway. Some of them are obscured by the title there, but again, this is just the, you know, art from the game assets, like the box and the instruction manual. I already recognize it. But, you know, the features are kind of well drawn. You've got like these sort of like plates that kind of look like they're made out of, I don't know, maybe gold or bronze or something with little rivets on the sides.
Yeah, it's a cool design. Yeah,
don't mind that stuff.
And they kind of try to explain how this thing works, you know, and the thing you're describing, these kind of like metal metallic sort of mounting plates that all the information about specific levels are contained within. You know, it all kind of fits together with like the vibe of the thing, and I like that. So
yeah, a little bit steampunky in a way.
A little bit steampunky, a little bit like, you know, kind of 80s action movie-ish as well. There's some attempt at like explaining how you want to create like a team of two characters that have like complementary abilities. This feature suggests that the AI for the computer controlled second character, if you're only playing in one player, is a lot better than it actually ends up being in the game itself. I'm not surprised that that's the tack they want to take with this here, because just being like, yeah, you're supposed to be able to play this one player, but really it's a pretty different experience, because it never feels like the second character is doing much of anything.
It'll be interesting when we get to the now playing section if they're a little bit more honest about that, because sometimes they tend to be.
Yeah, sometimes they do tend to be. So
but yeah, you know, once again we get nice big old maps of all the levels here,
pointing out kind of various traps and hazards, pointing out where some power-ups are, and this I think covers like the first, I guess you'd say like the first biome of the game. There's more of the game that they don't cover here. They kind of tease at the end of this. We liked Soldier of Fortune pretty well, so
yeah, it was all right. It was okay.
It was okay. Yeah,
it was perfectly fine.
It certainly had a vibe.
Still questioning the decision to rename this Soldiers of Fortune instead of Chaos Engine.
Very much so. Chaos Engine's such a better name. Like, seriously.
And we turn the page and we get our poster. It is Bugs Bunny, Rabbit Rampage. We've got a whole lot of Looney Tunes characters.
Why do we have such a small Marvin the Martian on this?
Because, you know, we had to fit him in there somewhere.
I don't know. The perspective here is really strange, actually, I have to admit.
Yeah, they just kind of haphazardly put the characters around where I guess it made some kind of sense to have them. Tasmanian Devil looks real weird. Like, he just looks like it's the top half of his body.
You can see that there's like the little like cyclone happening if you really look at the area where his legs should be, but it's really hard to see on this poster. It's like in front of some leaves. I don't know.
Did they just forget to color it in? Because I'm seeing like the lines. It looks like they just did the line work.
Yeah, usually that is like solid color. So I don't know. I don't think this is a great poster, personally. Like, I think this is pretty weak in terms of Nintendo Power posters.
No, it's not amazing. And it'll be interesting to see how the game turns out to be. We've had, what, like two Looney Tunes games so far?
Yeah, we had that Daffy Duck one, and we had the Tasmania game.
I guess three if you count Tasmania, because yeah, we also had the Roadrunner game, didn't we?
Oh yeah, we did have the Roadrunner game. I forgot about the Roadrunner game because it was a while ago. And it's sort of just like Looney Tunes adjacent, but we did have the very good Tiny Toons game. Yeah. Buster Buzz Lose. Mainline, you know, old school Looney Tunes have not had great representation on this system. There have been several games. They've mostly been pretty weak.
Yeah, it's interesting that they're using Rabbit Rampage as the basis for the Bugs Bunny game. Because if I'm remembering correctly, like, this is a cartoon where, like, the animator is messing with bugs.
No. That's not that one. That's Duck-a-Muck.
Well, no, but there were two of them. There was one where Bugs was messing with Daffy, and there was another one where Elmer Fudd was messing with Bugs.
Oh, I don't remember that. Okay, fair enough.
That's why it's weird, because, like, Duck-a-Muck is the far more popular and successful short than Rabbit Rampage.
Absolutely. I didn't even know about Rabbit Rampage, so there you go. And then next up, we've got Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Tournament Fighters, another game that we pretty recently talked about, getting the full feature treatment here. Yeah, this was one that we turned around on pretty considerably, or at least that I turned around on pretty considerably from the low opinion of it that I had going into playing that game.
Yeah, I definitely have a higher opinion of it as well when we revisited it for this show. I think this is a pretty solid fighting game. The system has had a lot of fighting games. None of them come close to matching the quality of Street Fighter 2, but I think this is one of the better ones that isn't Street Fighter 2, and I think it made a lot of sense to use the Ninja Turtles for a game like that. You've got a stable of very memorable characters with very different personalities who mostly fight in hand-to-hand combat. Like, it's a no-brainer. So for this feature, we get some interesting art of the turtles.
We certainly do. I have a suspicion this is not from Capcom.
You mean Konami?
Yes, I do mean Konami. I always think of fighting games as Capcom projects because Konami, frankly, didn't make that many of them. But you're right, this is a Konami game because they have the Turtles license. I don't think this is from them somehow. Largely because some of these things look weirdly off-model. The one original character, Asuka, there is just like a bizarre drawing of her that looks nothing like that character.
I'm just checking the instruction manual really quick to see if the art kind of lines up.
That's usually where the art comes from if we don't recognize it, so that makes sense.
Yeah. Okay, so you know what? There's... So, like, in the actual instruction manual, it looks like just kind of uncolored line work in the background that pretty similar to the... Although, no, this one doesn't quite match up. I don't know, like, the weird picture of Leonardo doing the sword slash with the fireball coming out of it, that is exactly the same, down to the incredibly goofy grin that he's got.
Uh-huh.
Also, his stuff looks purple in this instead of blue, so I wonder if like the Nintendo Power artist colored it in and did it wrong.
Maybe that's like what contributes to some of it looking a little odd, because it doesn't look that far off, but it just doesn't look right.
These could even be just like redrawings of these pictures. Let's see, we got that.
Yeah, totally.
Okay, no, that picture of Asuka is very different from the one that's in the instruction manual. So,
I mean, basically, Asuka's a cute anime girl, and the one that's in the magazine looks to me like a character from like a really cheaply made, like a Malibu comic or something.
The Armageddon picture looks similar, but like Wingnut is different. Asuka's very different. Yeah, it's kind of a mishmash. It wouldn't surprise me if these were like redraws of that art from the instruction manual and also colored by folks at Nintendo Power.
You know, we do get a piece of art for each of the characters here. And we also get the little specular grid showing like strengths and weaknesses of each character, where they're strong and weak in various skills, like, you know, power and attack and speed and all that stuff. And we get, you know, some move lists. And yeah, like, it's, you know, it's a fighting game feature. This is kind of how they do these. I actually do appreciate that we do have, it looks like, full move lists for all the characters on a big grid.
I think that they've done a pretty good job of laying out all the special moves in this issue in a way that they didn't always do with like some of the earlier Street Fighter 2 games.
No, yeah, they've clearly like learned how to present a fighting game, like kind of like a quick strategy guide for a fighting game in the magazine.
Yeah,
pretty good feature for a pretty good game.
Then we get Super Solitaire. That's a card game.
It's a card game. It's Solitaire.
I guess, yeah, you got all these different versions of Solitaire. That'll be something for us to look forward to in a wrap up episode, almost certainly.
Then definitely in a wrap up episode. I cannot in any way imagine us wanting to devote a feature slot to a solitaire game, even one that does have mouse control, which this one does. Anything to say about Super Solitaire before we move on?
Not even a little, no.
Well, if we turn the page from there, we have classified information. This is kind of cheats and tips and tricks for various games. And, you know, we have kind of a mix of older games and some pretty recent ones in here. Any of these stick out to you?
Well, has Final Fight 2 come out yet, according to our...
I think we have played Final Fight 2.
Did we play Final Fight 2?
I think it's on our list.
Oh, okay. Well,
I mean, I think I feel like I remember it being like a big upgrade from Final Fight 1.
Yeah, maybe my head's just still stuck in Final Fight because we talked about it a second time recently. Because we just
played that for, yeah. Okay,
well, fair enough then. Let's see here. What else we got? Oh, we got Mortal Kombat, Falcon's Revenge over there. We got old school Metroid.
We've also got ActRaiser 2. I've got a secret code for ActRaiser 2. It's called the off switch. Turn the system off and don't play that game. That's what I say.
Wise decision. Cool. Good stuff. Also, just notice we still got Nestor in his little detective coat.
As far as I'm concerned, the only really good image of Nestor.
Yeah, this might be one of the last like places Nestor is going to pop up on the magazine, because I'm not sure that we keep getting Nestor comics this year.
I hope that little gremlin goes away and I don't have to see him more than is absolutely necessary.
Yeah. We have not been big fans of the Nestor comics. Maybe someday we'll go back and like to the Howard and Nestor era to see if there's any redemption to be had for Nestor.
Yeah, maybe those are better. You know, it is pretty funny, though. Pretty good and funny is the comic that's in this one, our yearly installment of Mario versus Wario. We had one of these in the January 93 issue, and we've got another one here.
Yeah, and I think this is the only other one of these that we get, but it is very charming. It is an absolutely adorable comic. Yeah,
I love it, yeah.
Mario and Wario have both been invited to Princess Toadstool because she's not Princess Peach yet, even though there is a picture of a Peach next to her name.
There is a picture of Peach next to her name. This, to me, also looks really similar to the letter you get at the beginning of Mario 64 inviting you to the castle.
For cake,
which is the one where they did actually make the name change happen in real time, because she signs it Princess Toadstool Peach.
From that moment forward, she would never be Princess Toadstool again, as far as Nintendo was concerned.
Never again. But yeah, this is such a cute comic. Do you want to keep describing it?
Yeah. So Mario and Wario simultaneously have gotten invitations to Peach's party, her birthday party, and they're both thinking like what they should get her for her birthday. And they both have the same idea, because they remember a time when all of them, the two of them, Luigi, Peach, and Toad, we're all just kind of walking around, and they saw a Samus doll in the window, which the Samus doll itself is also very adorable.
It's adorable. It's got little button eyes. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It's very funny. The idea that they exist in a world where Metroid merchandise is a thing and a Samus doll is something that Peach would want. There's no time to purchase it because they're going to miss their bus. Because the princess rides a bus?
She's a woman of the people. She rides the bus just like everybody else.
Good for her. Mario and Wario both realize that, at the same time, that they have to get the Samus doll for Peach. So Wario shows up at the toy store. There's a Koopa Troopa working there, and he's all like, hey, sorry, somebody already just bought this thing. And Wario is not happy about this, so he hatches a plan.
Importantly, you know, the guy who bought the doll was he had a big black mustache just like Wario, so it must be Mario who bought it. He buys this Jack in the Box, and what does he do with it?
So he gets the Jack in the Box. He has him wrap it for him. The Koopa Troopa says, "Sheesh, two weirdos in one day." That might be a little hint. So the following day, it is Peach's birthday. Mario shows up. He says hi to some toads.
Some really cute little circle-eyed toads here. Yeah.
Wario sees Mario coming with the present, and he's like, oh, I knew it. So he knew that Mario must have been the one to purchase that Samus doll out from under him, out from under his large bulbous nose. So he decides he's going to switch the presents around so that he can be the one to give Peach the Samus doll, and Mario will end up giving her a Jack in the Box that has been primed to spring as soon as the package is opened, making it appear as if Mario was playing a cruel prank on Peach instead of giving her a gift that she wanted. Peach asks Wario for some help. They put up a big old sign that says Happy Birthday Princess. The princess seems to be helping plan her own decorating and everything, I guess. Okay.
Once again, woman of the people, you know, not going to leave that to other folks.
While Wario's gone, he doesn't really get to see like what Mario's up to, but Mario goes and gets the door to let in the other guests, and Wario swaps the presents, and then he gives Peach his present, or what was actually Mario's present. She opens it, and then, oh, she gets pranked. It's a Jack in the Box. She gets freaked out.
No.
So, yeah, Mario says, whoa, Wario, great gift. Not because it's the 90s.
Because it's the 90s.
Quick side tangent. Remember when Cyclops did that in the old X-Men cartoon?
I sure do.
He does it again in the new one.
Now that is fan service right there. Yeah. That is some quality fan service.
Anyway, so Wario thinks he's somehow been bamboozled. Maybe Mario switched the gifts before he switched them. Anticipating he was going to do that, but Mario gives Peach
the other gift. Yeah.
So Mario and Wario start arguing. Wario says that Mario switched the presents, and he says, "No, I didn't." Peach is just not having this. She says, "You will both stop this at once." So use her princess authority a little bit to get these two ruffians to calm down at her birthday party. But she opens the other gift, and it's also a Jack in the Box.
Oh, no.
And she says, "Mario, not you too." And so Mario and Wario are both arguing. They start fighting each other, very upset. They're ruining Peach's birthday, but luckily Luigi swoops in, says, "Hey, I've got a present for you." She opens it, and it's the Samus doll. Luigi was the mustachioed man who actually bought the Samus doll.
It was him all along.
Yep. So when the Koopa Troopa said two weirdos in one day, presumably a similar interaction between him and Mario happened before Wario got there. But Luigi gets a little smooch from the princess. And Wario says, "Guy with a mustache." And Mario's saying, "My mustache looks like that?" Because,
yeah.
His mustache is different from Luigi's mustache. Dash.
Yeah, it's totally different. It's a little bit less curved.
It's got lumpier. It's maybe bushier.
Yeah.
You feel like Luigi waxes his more, you know?
Yeah, he's taking a little bit better care of that thing. Luigi gets a little smooch from the princess, and it's all very cute. I love the art in this. Like, I love all of the facial expressions, particularly Peach as she's like, or Toadstool, I guess, as she's opening the different boxes, and also Wario. There's a lot of good Wario takes here. It's really charming, and I would love a whole series of these, honestly.
Well, I've got some good news. We are going to eventually encounter the Super Mario World comics that were in the issue as we're kind of going back and revisiting those. No Wario in there, unfortunately.
No Wario in there, which is a shame. But I don't know. I like this. I think this is really good and fun. Also, sort of odd thing. The last couple weeks, the internet feels like it has been flooded with art of Peach and Samus smooching. So it's very funny to see the Samus doll pop up here as like the thing that she's so excited to get. So I don't really know why that's been a trend recently, but I mean, I'm not complaining about it, but it's just funny to see that overlap with when we're reading this magazine.
We must go to different corners of the internet because I have not encountered that.
I think we do. Yeah.
Never made it to America.
Some games that never made it to America. Yeah, let's talk about those.
This is a really interesting feature. This is not the sort of thing that Nintendo was doing a whole lot of, you know, kind of peeking behind the curtain to show folks what they were missing out on.
And they picked some interesting stuff to highlight here, too.
Very, yeah. So the first thing up here, like, these are games I'd never heard of.
I've never heard of this.
U.S. presidential election. And I'm not sure if this is the actual title of the game, or if they're just kind of talking about what this is.
I don't know. I suspect none of these are the actual titles of the games. My suspicion is that Mystery Novel, which we'll talk about in a bit, and the one that's just labeled here as Pachinko, are probably things that have different, more specific titles. U.S. presidential election's an odd one, though, and it kind of makes sense that something like this would exist, but it is also really weird.
This is I guess a presidential election simulator. This came out in 1988 for the Famicom. Yeah, this would have been when Bush was up for re-election, right?
This was when Bush was up for election because Reagan was finishing his second term.
Oh, right. Bush didn't win a second term. What am I saying? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Bush did not win a second term. He got beaten by Clinton in 92. I don't know. The way this is described here makes it sound kind of like a Koei game in some ways, or like it's a simulation of campaigning for president.
I was half expecting this to be a Koei game, but it's not. It is made by something named Hecht.
I don't know. It looks like the various candidates you can play as are lightly fictionalized versions of real candidates. So we've got George Push with a P, Jesse Zexen, Michael Dukakis, and Pat Roberts.
So their verdict on this: U.S. presidential election is certainly an innovative game, approaching a complex topic in a totally new medium. Even in game form, the process is complicated, though. They also says here, many people in Japan are fascinated by the U.S. political system. And I wonder if that's just because it's so stupid. Like, the Electoral College is so anti-democratic.
I know. It's like, wait, how does this work? Are you sure?
Yeah, is it like fascination or is it morbid curiosity? Like, wow, I can't believe you would pick such a f***ed up way of picking the leader of your country.
This is a game that, because I don't think we said this, designed to help educate interested Japanese people about the way the American, like, election system works. So,
or doesn't work.
I do think it's kind of fascinating.
Another thing that's perhaps much more fascinating is the game designer. It appears that there was a piece of software on the Famicom that let people kind of design their own games, which how was that not more of a thing back then?
I don't know. I really don't. And it looks like you can essentially design the assets and pick background music and, you know, change a bunch of variables for, like, you know, a shmup. And yeah, it looks like there's like a pretty neat, like, kind of sprite editor for you to draw your own sprites on, like, a, you know, like a 12 by 12 grid.
Yeah, honestly, after Mario Paint ended up being a thing, it seems like you could have made something like this with a similar interface to Mario Paint, even if it is just like, hey, this is a game where you're just making a simple space shooter shmup kind of game, which, you know, this is. It says right here, like, you know, you're limited to a standard three-stage space shooter. That's still pretty neat that you can create the assets for it and just kind of make it your own in a way. I feel like that would have been a pretty big hit. I feel like that's maybe a bit of a missed opportunity, you know, and I think once we finally, you know, get to the end of this project and we can kind of do a moratorium on Super Nintendo, I feel like there's going to be, you know, and I mean, hindsight's 2020 and all, but I feel like there's a lot more that could have been done with the Super Nintendo. People had maybe just thought outside the box a little bit more, and this is exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about. This would have been cool. I would have loved the hell out of something like this back in the day. Next up, we've got a Super Famicom game called, that they just simply call Mystery Novel.
This seems to be a kinetic novel. Kinetic novels are kind of like a form of visual novel where you are mostly having the story conveyed via text over kind of simple sort of abstract backgrounds with a lot of sound effects or like actual movement of text on the screen. I have not played very many games like this, but I find it like a pretty fascinating sort of form of like interactive fiction. And this seems like almost like a horror game from the way they're describing it here. Like less of a mystery and more of kind of like a, you know, a creepy haunted house game.
Again, this seems like something that I definitely knew a lot of kids who would have been super into something like this back in the day. I probably would have enjoyed playing something like this with other kids. I don't know if I would have been brave enough to do something like this on my own back in the day, but I think it's a real shame we didn't get any, you know, graphic novel type games that were very big in Japan. This already looks like it's covering much more mature content than what Nintendo of America was really willing to put out, especially in the early days of the Super Nintendo. Also, there's just, you know, the whole thing that, like, back in the day, maybe a game like this would have been difficult to do in English just because Japanese, you've got a lot of characters, but
yeah,
you don't need quite as much real estate on the screen to present all that text.
I mean, definitely Yeah, I mean, definitely a big reason why several pretty major Japanese games never came out in English is because of those kinds of size limitations. There simply wasn't enough space to do an adequate translation of those and get it into a format that could be displayed in English or onto a cartridge that could store that amount of information.
Yeah, we've got Barcode Battler or Barcode Battle for Game Boy, which now this was a thing back in the 90s, right? Barcode battlers were it was like a little handheld device that would let you scan barcodes. And was this a 90s thing or was this a 2000s thing? I'm not even sure.
I kind of feel like this was more of a 2000s thing, but I think it was just like a thing that was generally just kind of around. We finally got something like that. It was like early 2000s.
I know it became a thing at some point, but I was kind of like not in the target demographic for that sort of thing anymore by the time it did happen. But yeah, I guess they were doing this for a long time over in Japan, and there was even a version for Game Boy that you could just put onto the top of the Game Boy unit, plug it in to one of the Game Boy's ports, and then you would get these little cards that would have barcodes on them that you just kind of like run them. Looks like a credit card kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. Kind of swipe it through, I guess. And, in this game that they're presenting here, this is for essentially kind of like a creature battling RPG, it looks like.
Yeah.
Like a pre-Pokemon sort of creature battler, where you can get different creatures by scanning different barcodes. And I think this sounds neat.
Yeah. And another thing that's neat is we get a look at Fire Emblem over here.
Yeah, it's Fire Emblem. Probably this must have been one of the first times they ever mentioned Fire Emblem in Nintendo Power, right?
It might be. I don't know if there was ever any talk about the possibility of bringing a Fire Emblem game over before this.
We wouldn't start getting Fire Emblem games until the early 2000s, yeah, right? Yeah, until
Marth and Roy were in Smash Brothers and people were like, hey, who are those guys?
It's like, yeah, it's kind of like an RPG, but with a lot of strategy elements to it. And it's pretty complicated.
Way too complicated for you, silly American.
That is kind of a theme here, actually, is, Americans like action games. They don't like all these really complicated strategy games and RPGs that are so popular in Japan.
Yeah. And hey, look, we're skipping over all the Koei RPGs on our show, so I guess we're not doing a great job of dispelling that myth.
Yeah, we're not. We're kind of living down to the stereotype here.
And we've got Pachinko. We've got a Pachinko game for the Super Famicom made by Coconuts Japan.
There is not a single thing in the world that would make me actually want to play a dedicated Pachinko game, like Pachinko video game, or just Pachinko in general. It is a pretty big thing in Japan, so I understand why they have it highlighted here.
We have Mind Seeker, which according to Mind Seeker, you can increase your psychic powers by practicing the exercises presented by the game, which was designed with the help of a well-known Japanese psychic, so a fraud.
So obviously very trustworthy. Yeah. I feel like I've heard of this thing before, right? I feel like this one is famous enough that it gets talked about when people talk about like odd curios of like Japanese game history that never came out over here.
Possible. I'll be honest, I'm not familiar with this one.
Just in exactly the way it's presented here, basically. Just like, oh yeah, there was like this weird psychic power boosting game that was designed with under the auspices of some kind of celebrity psychic in Japan. Isn't that weird?
It is weird. It kind of makes me think of Taboo, the Sixth Sense on the NES, which was just like a weird...
Yes, it did make me think of that too. The fortune-telling game.
Yeah, the weird tarot reading game. But I guess I feel like it was kind of meant to be sort of tongue-in-cheek, you know? Like look, it's tarot. It's just...
Yeah.
It's just an entertainment thing. We're not making any claims that you're actually going to be able to, you know, win your state's lottery tomorrow, even though they did give you like lucky numbers that you could adjust based on the state that you lived
they
in.
They did do that, yes. Next thing up, we've actually got something else that has sort of a greater legacy. Mother, aka Earthbound. Earthbound Zero, I guess, is what we would call this, given that that's what it ended up ultimately being put out in America as. But yeah, there's a blurb here about the NES game Mother, which is the predecessor to the Super Nintendo, Super Famicom game that we know as Earthbound. But yeah, description of it here, wears a, actually, notes the presence of Itoi, the writer of that game, who is, you know, a celebrity writer in Japan who
there's also a little blurb here about how there were plans to release this in America as Earthbound originally, but because Dragon Warrior didn't sell quite as well over here as it did in Japan, they decided not to do that because they didn't think it would be worth it, because RPGs weren't very popular over here yet. But yeah, they would end up using that name for the sequel when it came out over here.
Yeah, they would. And yeah, and as we kind of know now, with the, you know, benefit of 30 more years of history between then and now, they actually had a fully produced localization of this game ready to go, that they just didn't do it because of the reasons stated here, that, you know, they didn't think an RPG was a safe bet. But yeah, that's like the translation that existed at the point when this magazine was written is the one that ultimately ended up coming out here when they put this game out on, what was that, on the Wii U Virtual Console? Is that how we ended up getting this thing?
Possibly. I can't remember now. Mother or Earthbound Zero or whatever they ended up calling it. But we still haven't ever gotten Mother 3 in any form.
Nope, we never have.
Okay. Ultra Quiz.
Ultra Quiz across America. That's the next game in this feature. It is a game based on a Japanese game show that I don't think I've ever heard of this one.
Yeah, I'm not too familiar with it either. We do have a nice New York skyline on that title screen, it looks like, with the Twin Towers there. So I don't know if this is, like, about American trivia, that they're quizzing Japanese people about American trivia, or if like, I'm just kind of skimming this here.
So apparently they did do a season of this show that they filmed. Basically, the gimmick of this show is that they start out with like an enormous number of contestants, like a stadium full of contestants, and then they cut that by half each episode of the show as they move from location to location. And apparently they did a season of it in American locations where they took a route across the U.S. doing this format for the show. And this game follows that season, basically. So
interesting. Okay.
Yeah, it is interesting. But yeah, I don't really know what this show was like. I know that at the time, at least in the 90s, there was a real reputation in America that Japanese game shows were extremely mean-spirited and humiliating. Probably because of... If not outright violent. Probably because at least some people in America had seen the extremely popular Takeshi's Castle, which is kind of that. But I don't really know if that was, like, overall the way that those shows were, or if that was kind of an outlier that was just extremely visible and popular.
Maybe that combined with just it sort of being a somewhat xenophobic stereotype. Like, there's that SNL sketch from back in the day that had, you know, like Mike Myers and a few other SNL people just straight up doing yellow face.
Just straight up doing yellow face.
Weird Japanese game show. Oh boy.
I mean, end of the 90s, there was a very unfortunate Simpsons episode where they go to Japan, and that episode also indulges in a ton of really bad, gross stereotypes about Japanese people, and I'm pretty sure has an almost entirely white cast of actors portraying anybody in Japan, so that they run into in that episode. So yeah, 90s was comfortably xenophobic about Japanese culture, definitely.
New Demon Island, that's another game that made by Nintendo, I guess. I'm not terribly familiar with this one. I don't know much about New Demon Island. I imagine it's somewhat adjacent to Old Demon Island, but I don't know for sure.
Different municipal infrastructure, but frankly, pretty similar, you know, either one, you're kind of having the same experience if you go there, I think. And, yeah, I don't know. Any of the rest of these games sticking out to you?
Because I'm not Tina Belcher, I can't say I have too much interest in the horse racing Game Boy game Off to the Races.
So that one's weird to me, actually, because it's not even a horse racing game. It's like a weird thing where you can, like, you can enter information from real-life horse races, and it will tabulate who you should bet on. It's like a betting aid. Which is a really odd thing. I guess horse racing and betting on horse races is also a thing in Japan that's pretty popular, at least according to this.
Okay. Well, I guess that's one of the other things, one of the other gambling things that are allowed over there. I don't know. Put all my money on Eat My Shorts to bring everything back to The Simpsons.
That's right. I do think it's funny here. We have a little blurb about a Dragon Ball Z game, which they clearly did not know how to read that title, because they do call it Dragon Balls, like B-A-L-L-Z.
They do!
Yeah, they clearly do not actually have a sense of what the title of that thing is supposed to be. And there's almost no information about it other than that the artist who did the art for Dragon Warrior also drew the Dragon Ball art, which they do mention here, RIP Akira Toriyama. You were one of the best. Yeah. But yeah, there's a little thing here about Dragon Warrior V, a great game that never came out in its original form here in the U.S. And also a little thing here about Final Fantasy II, III, and V, which it's talking about NES or Famicom II and III. And then 5, which they say is going to be coming out in the U.S. as Final Fantasy III late in 94. Clearly sometime between then and a little bit later, they decided to skip 5 as well and just release 6 here as Final Fantasy III.
Yeah, so they sure did. We also have some political mahjong. I don't know what makes
political mahjong. Makes yeah,
political. Oh, because you're playing against political figures. Interesting.
You're playing against political figures. That's what the deal is in this one. So that is an interesting thing.
We got some shogi, which is like that weird Japanese variant of chess. We got more pachinko, and yeah, we got the rest of the packs. Our list of games available in Japan, but not around here, is far from complete.
But yeah, we've spent a lot of time going through this section, but it's just really striking that, like, this is not the kind of article that this magazine publishes.
I mean, like, I think it would have been awesome if we could have gotten, like, something like this in every issue, just breaking down, like, hey, here's some cool things in Japan. And it could have been a good way to, like, maybe start gauging some interest. Like, okay,
yeah,
what
right?
might American kids actually be kind of into? And
right, if they write an article about this and then a bunch of people, like, write in saying, oh, that actually seems really interesting, I want to know more about that, maybe that wakes its way back up to, you know, the people who make those decisions at Nintendo, and we end up getting a translated version of the, you know, mystery novel game or what have you. You know?
Yeah, or maybe just, you know, like a game similar to that that is a little bit more simplified for American audiences, and it, you know, cut down on the amount of text that would be needed so it actually fits on a cartridge. But, you know, I mean, not that like the Japanese Super Famicom library fills in all of the gaps that I could imagine you could have done, you know, with a little more hindsight and with maybe, you know, like a few more years of development on that system. But
yeah,
you could definitely get more of a variety of kinds of games that showed up over here if more of that was included. So
for sure.
And so, like, yeah, at least one game in there that I don't know about that I've got to, like, look up now and just be like, this, I just want to see what this was like. I want to see what this is all about. Hey, everybody. Well, it's time to wrap up this one, I think. We've gone on long enough. We will continue this one on in part 2. Sorry about the audio quality on this one. I'm not sure what's going on with my mic, but I know that I sound a little bit blown out, and that will continue in the next episode, unfortunately, because we recorded this whole thing in one go. Trying to get to the bottom of it, hopefully this sounds better, and hopefully this won't be a problem going forward. But anyway, thank you all for putting up with it, I guess. Hope you all enjoyed this episode anyway. Hope you all will stick around for the next one. Part 2 drops next week. So until then, for ME0, I am Chase Keys. Play it loud. For show notes, game rankings, links to social media, research references, and more, check out our website, snescapades.show. Our intro-outro song is How Now Brown Cow by TechnoAxe, who very generously offers a ton of great music for free at technoaxe.com, TEKNOAXE.com. Thanks for listening.